welcome to episode 99 of the OmniGamers Club podcast, the podcast for games on all platforms, including your kids demanding to recreate every game from the show Bluey. I am Daniel Winter.
And I'm Mark Uwasa. Hey, it's the episode before 100, Daniel.
Yes, yeah, and so I don't think we ever officially described when we jumped to the new format. We may have sort of skipped a few numbers there, because we retroactively included the playlists as sort of numbered episodes. So in total, we're approaching the big centenary there, so we'll have to think about something special to do, perhaps.
That's right, let's make it happen.
And if I'm looking and sounding any different today, that is because, unfortunately, my computer has decided to die out of the blue. So, struggling to find some local repair shops here. So, we'll see what we can do. But haven't had to MacGyver up a little setup on my tablet in the meantime.
Yeah, that is a real shame.
Right as I was getting really hooked into Returnal as well. So, maybe more on that another time.
Nice. All right, well, let's hope the best for your device.
Sure.
Today.
So, yeah, I've still not played that many tabletop games lately. In the aftermath of TCTC, we've had some debriefs from that, that it sort of got in the way of regular game nights and just catching up on sleep still, for one thing. But one thing I have been doing is playing a lot more games with my kid over the last few months. And there's a few games I've been wanting to discuss in regards to that that haven't been the right opportunity to. So I just wanted to do a little grab bag. Some of the games I've been playing and some of the lessons and experiences in playing with the kids. So my daughter is currently 5 and starting to expand her horizons beyond like harbor games. I did, though, check out a couple of weeks ago. We had some downtime in the city, so I took her to our friendly local game store, Rain City Games. So they have a library of games to play in store. So I pulled up a table and sort of had a chance to try a few games, see if she sort of gelled with them before committing to them, right? So one I'd been hearing some buzz about, harbor game called Dragon's Breath. So this won the Kinderspiel, I think, in like 2017, 18, thereabouts. I've been hearing about it since. And it's a real little banger of a game. I could easily see a sort of punch-up version for regular gamers. Basically, you've got these plastic rings, like these transparent plastic rings about an inch or two wide that stack up to form this tower. And you fill the tower with multicolored gems. And one of the time you're going to yank up one of those rings, gems are going to tumble out. But before you do that, everyone has to try and bet basically what color is going to fall out the most. And like you pick, I'll pick red and my daughter will pick blue and you might pick green. And any of those colors that fall out, you claim those as points. There's basically a little bit of like betting almost, like got to hook them on that early. But this also has a dexterity sort of tactile element and seeing things tumble out. It reminds me of those arcade games where you slot the coin in and the little draw pushing the coins back and forth, and you sort of nice little dexterity element there. So yeah, I could easily see quite a bit of fun being made of that. We played it. I heard it literally like shut it off after like 3 or 4 rounds. Okay, let's play a different game. We can't just keep playing Dragon's Breath.
That's cool. Yeah, I have a game I played recently that touches upon kids and betting as well. But I was inspired recently by, we met up with Greg Loring Albright, who was
yes,
a guest on our show previously. He was visiting town for doing an academic kind of exchange at UBC. And we played a classic game I really enjoy, a trick-taking game called
Chronicle?
What is it? Chronicle, yeah. Chronicle by Seiji Kanai of Love Letter fame. So I really enjoyed that. We only played a one round.
Yes, yeah. But, Greg was still a bit jet-lagged.
Yeah, that's right. But I was reminded of how much I enjoyed playing that back in the day. And in honor of that, I played a bit of Love Letter with my kids.
Interesting.
Reintroduced them to that, and that was fun. And I also played a bit of The Gang as well. I introduced The Gang to my children. My wife was feeling a little under the weather, so just my kids. And they both got really into it. And of course, we didn't, bet money. They know poker, but they're getting to know it better and judging the relative values of cards. It was really enjoyable. And my youngest just wanted to keep playing. And I also had to cut them off as well.
They can use it as a maths, like statistical lesson, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. Being able to count the cards, count the odds.
Excellent. One other quick game I will shout out was called Spots. So I've played this a few times with friends and had a blast. It's basically you have a section of cards picturing dogs. Dogs with spots. Dogs have spots. Dice have spots. You've got to match the dice. The pips on the dice to the dice symbols on the dogs. Easy. But there's, I figured she would really love that concept. She did. The problem being the sort of action selection you do, you have this like basically six different tiles that have like a wide variety of how many dice you get to roll, how many times you get to re-roll them, and different actions, which with a lot of words. We're not quite up to speed with reading yet, so I had to like improvise a family mode on the fly that didn't include all of those. And let's just roll three dice a turn. I'll give you a re-roll now and then. So I had to do some like impromptu game design on the fly there, but that core concept of matching the dogs up. And she was very skeptical of Doug, who is absolutely a dog, if you've played that game. Had some fun with Spots as well. Unfortunately, hard to find. And when you can find it, very expensive in Canada. But that is a classic.
Well, that's cool. I think I've seen some art for that. That game is a little intriguing too. Unfortunately, games are just getting more and more expensive in Canada in general, aren't they?
Yes, yeah.
For various reasons.
Yeah. So one other one I wanted to mention that in more in line with sort of some light role playing, I haven't quite gotten myself up to DMing with her yet. I've got No Thank You Evil I'd like to run with her sometime. A bit hard with this one-on-one. I need to, like, to get her some of her friends into that as well, perhaps. But in the meantime, what I have been playing is Wilmot's Warehouse, which is basically, I mean, it's based on the video game, but works quite differently in that it's kind of a memory game. You're revealing these tiles with abstract shapes and colors, laying them into a grid face down. You have to remember where they are, but you basically form a story connecting all of these as part of a sort of little mimetic memory reminder and creating stories to connect the symbols and how you interpret them. So she's really been enjoying that as like it's good practice for me with like doing some impromptu storytelling, and she loves it as well. So hoping that sort of can branch out into some more role playing with her perhaps sometime. And finally, there's one other one that I've been playing some video game. I've been playing video games that she watches, but it's been really a real struggle to get her to play games and actually get a controller in her hands. But I finally did it. I've got her playing Mario Kart for the first time after she showed some interest at the it was an arcade version she was playing. So I think it was Mario Day recently. There was a sale on one of those rare Nintendo sales. Got a copy of Mario Kart 8, and she has wanted to play it every day since. So it's some great accessibility features in there. I've had to like create new goals for myself, so I'm not like winning every game. Like my current meta is I hang back in like second and just bully whichever NPC is in first to give her a chance to catch up. So it's a great game, and hoping that it branches into some other video games soon for her too.
Very nice. My quick news will be Nintendo related as well. Of course, there was a Direct recently, and of course, everyone's looking forward to the Nintendo Switch 2 Direct, which is forthcoming for us. It may have already happened by the time you hear this. April 2nd, I believe it is. And there might be, I think the rumor was that there might be a pre-order happening that day as well. So I'm going to keep my eyes open for it. But the other news tidbit I thought was interesting, aside from all the games, was the talk about the virtual game cards. Now, this intrigued me. It was a little bit confusing, so I dug into it a little bit more closely. I'll share a link to a news story about this in our show notes. But basically, you always were able to share games between family members in Nintendo Switch. It was a little bit nebulous exactly how it worked. So you could always play the same like copy, quote unquote, of a game, so long as the primary member, myself, owned the game on any of the devices. But you couldn't necessarily play all games on the secondary Switch devices, and that's how it normally works.
Right.
And I think like that kind of uncertainty, exactly what it feels like, I guess, caused Nintendo to, all these years later, what is it? Switch is like 8 years old or something now. All these years later, decide to invent this new metaphor called virtual game cards. So basically, these are like cartridges that are virtual that you basically pop in and pop out of a device.
Seems like they're trying to recapture that nostalgia of like from the 90s of physically trading video game cartridges with your friends. Like I remember trading Mario All-Stars with one of my neighbors, and I gave him Banjo-Kazooie, whatever it was.
Yeah, it's a little bit unclear whether it'll be extended to everyone, but from what I've read, it's for family members, whatever that will be. I think you can establish family groups. I have for my kids and my wife.
You have to have like a physical connection with the other switches that you're sharing with, right? At least when you first like sync up.
Yes.
Like the old Game Boy Link cables.
Yeah, this new virtual game card system requires near field communication, so you actually have to be in proximity, like you were alluding to the other switch, which is a totally different restriction I don't think existed before. And basically, you can eject a virtual game card from one system and then load it onto another system, and basically lends a virtual copy to them for I think a maximum of 14 days.
It was like two different versions of it though, and that works slightly differently, like whether it's a family system or there's the family network through Nintendo Online. So yeah, it's quite a convoluted system with various conditions and exceptions.
Yeah, so I think they've made it slightly clearer, but not entirely clear, even as for me, I've read through this article a couple of times now. And apparently, the interesting thing was that I just found out after reading the article in more depth is that this is a optional change. Hmm. You can actually revert to the original system. This new system of virtual game card lending is not a requirement. So that was a relief to me. I think it seemed like from watching the video that this was intended to be sort of like a constraint on like reselling games or giving them away or being able to play multiple copies at the same time. I think you always were restricted from playing the very same game at the very same time on multiple devices.
Yeah,
like even within a family.
If two kids wanted to play Animal Crossing at the same time, you had to buy two Switches and two copies of the game.
Yeah.
And there's not much way around that. And even still, like you've got two kids wanting to play one game, but they have to like trade back and forth, and every time they want to change, they have to, I'll unload my card and you can load it up on your end. And a lot of back and forth. It seems quite fiddly for the people who this would in theory benefit from it.
Right. So it's not a perfect system yet, and it's not a perfectly free system or trusting system, even within families. I think other systems are a little bit more permissive, like Xbox does it fairly well. We can't play exactly the same game at the same time, but you can handle multiple devices in the same household. I deal with that with my kid quite a bit. And I think Steam Family Lending is quite permissive, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I've not used that myself, but so I've heard, yeah.
Yeah. So anyways, this sense new world of virtual lending is not perfect just yet, but I guess they're trying to do something generally good for the end user. So unsure yet whether this will be a good move or not.
We'll see. Hopefully it makes more sense with the Switch 2 and when we have more information there.
For sure. Keep an eye open for that. All right. That's all I have for news tidbits. How about yourself?
No, that's it for me. Why don't we roll into the main course?
Let's do it. All right. Did you want to talk about your game first?
Yeah, sure. So speaking of playing games with my daughter, I've been exploring some other options for games that I could play that she'd sort of be into watching. And one that's been on my radar for a little while is Kena: Bridge of Spirits. And I came across this at my local library, not even the Big Fat Library. My local library turns out has a default sort of lending period of 3 weeks instead of just 1 week, which was a lovely discovery. So I grabbed that. And what I hadn't realized is this game actually came out on PlayStation in September 2021. So quite a few years ago, but it only just came out on Xbox 6 months ago. What was that? August 2024. So relatively new to Xbox. This is developed and published by Ember Lab. If you're watching a trailer for Kena, you would be forgiven for mistaking this as a sort of lost Disney movie that you'd never seen. It's quite explicitly very inspired by that sort of Pixar, Disney house style, a sort of, you know, a lot of soft round edges on characters, big eyes. She looks like a Disney princess, basically. But they use that for like really good effect in just terms of the quality of the animation here is pretty strong. For a very small team, I think it's just 15 people on this team. So yeah, it's incredibly lush level design and characters, and a lot of fully rendered cutscenes for the story going on here. And the studio actually, I think they got their start as basically doing like fan videos. There was a Majora's Mask short called, I can't remember. I'll look that up. I'll drop it in the show notes. But it was like a fan trailer for like a Majora's Mask that was really high quality. Even like it was like 10 years ago. I was just looking at it now and it still really holds up. So go check that out. And this is their first attempt at an actual full-on game. They've done some ad work and shorts, but this is their first video game. So yeah, really curious to see this new debut offering. So it's basically a character platformer. You know, your Spyro the Dragon, your Gex, Psychonauts is one of the few sort of more recent games in that genre. One that I really, you know, loved growing up, like Banjo-Kazooie, which I just mentioned earlier. So Kena here is playing a spirit guide, basically, is the gist of the story here. She's come to this village for reasons unknown, and seemingly most of the people in this village are already dead, and you're helping them move on through various means. And that acts out very sort of formulaically. You have to collect their three MacGuffins, and then that will sort of unlock you to talk them through their grief and their grief or rage or whatever it was that caused them to die. Not of course, before fighting them as a boss, for reasons. So it's a little formulaic. You've seen all this before, but it is presented in this very earnest way. Incredible animation, very lush level design, as I was saying. But it's very interesting in that it's very clearly inspired by a lot of sort of Asian culture. You've got especially Japanese and Indonesian culture. You've got sort of very kitsune looking statues everywhere. You've got monsters popping up. Like an early boss is called a kappa, but doesn't look or act anything like that sort of creature. So it's sort of picking and choosing, mixing and matching a lot of sort of Asian influences here. In all respect, they do seem to be making an effort to be respectful in how they use it. The music, which is excellent, like there's really lots of layered folk music that it's layered in this really expressive way. Has an incredible amount of layers to the music, as it sort of will start as these sort of very quiet moments and then rise up to this huge crescendo during the actions. And apparently was all created with in collaboration with a Balinese music studio. And all of the voice acting, or at least most of the main characters are voiced by people from these cultures. So there has been an effort made there. I would have perhaps liked them to put a bit more thought into not just like dropping names and images from those cultures and maybe do something a little more unique with them, perhaps. But I can't really speak to that personally, obviously. But you can see a lot of Ghibli influence there very, very clearly, especially in that one of the things you're doing here is there's these little rot spirits. But basically, he's acting as something like Kodama, like sort of spirits of the forest. They sort of mass around. You're collecting them over the course of the game, up to the point where you're getting like up to 100 of them. You start out with just a couple. You're collecting these over the course of the game. They're basically acting like Pikmin. So one of those little guys ordering them around, a little bit like a game that I quite enjoyed called Overlord, I think it was, which had you, it was like a third person action game where you're playing like the villain in a sort of fantasy story and ordering these little minion Pikmin creatures around. So here you've got the rot spirits and you're using them for some puzzles, but also in combat in some pretty clever ways. But most importantly, I think it's just really cool. It's an incredible incentive as just a collectible. It's one of the most exciting collectibles you can get. A, I get a little guy to follow me around. And B, you can put hats on them. So one of the other collectibles is like there's something like 20 to 30 different hats you can collect over the course of the game, and you can customize which have what hats on. And it's just a nice little level of customization that I'm really appreciating. So the thing is, it does sort of cap at some point. Like you can collect up to 100 of them, but once you get beyond about 30, they sort of stop populating. I don't know whether that's a technical issue, but it doesn't sort of represent in game once you get past that sort of threshold. What does happen though is as you're exploring, you'll go inside a hut and to look for collectibles, and suddenly they all sort of dynamically just sort of pop around on the crates and the shelves, and they're just sitting there watching you. Or you're climbing, like this is sort of Uncharted style climbing sequences. You climb to the top of a cliff and they're all just standing on the edge waiting for you and looking out over the view. And so they do some clever things with like just populating the world with these creatures and using them to make it feel more alive in some really clever ways that I'm appreciating. So enjoying that. And I said you can also use them in combat. Combat is it's basically in like arenas. Like you'll do an exploring section and you'll come to an arena, time to fight. That starts out very simple. You've got your light attack, your heavy attack, your parry. Pretty simple. But they do start layering on some new mechanics pretty quickly. There's a bow that's that you get fairly early that becomes pretty key. A lot of comparisons have been made to Horizon Zero Dawn in some of the combats, and you can mix and match between sort of melee and ranged pretty seamlessly. And you can use the rot actually come into play in the combat as well, in that you basically build up these little ultimate meters that you can then spend to like throw them at the enemies, like stun them or supercharge some of your attacks. And so it's actually quite a lot of tools in your belt there by the end that I'm quite enjoying the combat there as well. So the one thing with the combat, though, it feels like it wants to be a Dark Souls game, in that the bosses are all pretty, even some of the regular enemies are all pretty involved with like pretty like complex attack patterns, multi-stage fights. You know, trying to figure out, oh, what can I dodge? What can I parry? Like, there is a parrying system as well. The problem is the game isn't quite tight enough to really warrant that. It's a little more, it's more difficult than it needs to be, especially with this very sort of kid-friendly sort of Disney aesthetic. The difficulty of the combat isn't quite right. And it's mostly a tuning issue, I feel. Like, had they just like tuned down some of the speed of the attack, some of the how much damage they do, wouldn't it be a big of an issue? But it's strange that they haven't sort of made it a little more friendly to younger players in that sense. It's quite intense, the combat, in ways that I'm enjoying, but it can get quite, it's not quite responsive enough for the sort of game that it seems to want to be, like chaining between some of the different combat, like throwing bombs and shooting arrows sometimes isn't incredibly responsive. The lock-on doesn't really work very well, I'll say. But otherwise, like those complaints aside, I'm really enjoying it. I could nitpick a lot of little things like with the UI and some of the level design that largely feel like it's a first game, right? It's a sort of thing that I can sort of forgive. It's a first game with a small team. It's not like it's not the best at any one thing, but it's an incredibly competent game, and I say that in the best way possible. For a first outing, it's a very strong game. It feels like a licensed game to like a lost Disney film. Again, also I mean that as a compliment, not particularly innovative or sort of ambitious, but it just is a nice little throwback to that genre that we haven't had a lot of these days. And my daughter is really loving it. She loves when I go into the spooky forest. one thing I didn't say is there's all this corruption. Like a big part of the story is you're sort of healing the corruption in the forest, largely represented by these big sort of flower bulbs that you have to like throw the rot at and shoot them with your arrow. But it feels like you're popping a pimple. And it's just a super satisfying moment every time you hit the bubble, it bursts, the forest becomes green again. Feels good.
To each their own, I guess, for popping pimple fun. I'm interested. I this genre of, I don't know, what did you call that? Mascot action or
character, kind of 3D character platformer action adventure. Yeah.
I played a little bit of this, but I feel like I kind of missed the generation where these were really popular. So a lot of these didn't really do anything for me. Of course, I played Ocarina of Time, classics like that, kind of genre defining games like that. Yeah, you mentioned the sort of like Ghibli as aesthetic thing. It's interesting now, right now in social media, where you're seeing the whole like AI generated meme imagery regenerated in Studio Ghibli style. And apparently they contacted Hayao Miyazaki, the director of all the most famous Ghibli films. And he said something to the effect of, this is like an insult to humanity itself or life itself. And, you know, that's, he's saying what a lot of us feel.
Mm.
And I can't imagine how he feels as the person who like originated these things out of heart and soul and blood and sweat and effort. It just strikes me as odd, ironic a little bit when every new media that comes out seems to say this is Ghibli inspired, or every solo TTRPG says this is Ghibli aesthetic, or this is cozy Ghibli vibes,
and,
or whatnot.
And it's always the cozy Ghibli. It's never the anti like environment destruction, the sort of the raging Ghibli, is it?
Yeah, it's not the Princess Mononoke scary sort of violence. Or like the political commentary Ghibli either. Yeah. It's just like cozy vibes, cute mascots. And it seems like Ghibli as an aesthetic has kind of replaced Disney as the stand-in for AKA creativity.
Mm.
Right?
It's a shorthand. And so,
right. It's a shorthand for creativity now. And that's why it's interesting that it's in the conversation of dialogue with generative AI, because generative AI has no creativity. It just is great at remixing and churning out kind of homogenized goop. Right.
Yeah, I wouldn't say this does a lot with those sort of Ghibli themes. There's not a lot of story, all things considered, once you pull out all of the platforming and combat arenas. It's pretty light in that regard. But there is some very earnest storytelling in terms of accepting death. Like, death is not a bad thing to be avoided here. It's just the peace and the characters exploring the peace and moving on and how that impacts the people left behind. So it's a very sort of positive take on death and moving on. But like I said, it's not going into any great detail in that regard. Kano herself, not much of a character, I will say.
Isn't that a lot of video game characters?
Yeah, though? Bit of a cipher.
Yeah, exactly. Speaking of which, if you're okay moving on to the next second game. Yeah, let's do it. Let's talk about a game produced by an Asian studio that's reinterpreting a lot of European setting and theme. This one is the game we've spoken about a little bit in the past, but I've been playing more intensely recently. It's called Metaphor Reinfantasio, the new JRPG from publisher Atlas. It was developed by Studio Zero, which I assume is one of their in-house development studios, directed by Katsura Hashino, and released for a bunch of platforms, you know, the modern ones, PlayStations, Windows, Xbox. And this game, you and I played, I think most people know that this is a reinterpretation or a continuation of the Persona-like JRPG, except it's nothing to do with modern-day Japan and teenagers going to school and contacting sort of yokai-like spirits. No, this time around, it's in a very inventive world. It's a fantasy world, an original fantasy world. And what's interesting about this fantasy world is it uses a lot of tropes like elves and beasts and flying ships and kingdoms and queens and princesses and things like that. But it also integrates a lot of steampunk, and it integrates a great degree of sort of like social commentary into it. But before we delve too deep into that, I just wanted to say that it's a unique in a lot of ways. It's sort of like a JRPG and a European fantasy story seen through a fractured prism. For instance, one of the very first things you see when the intro video loops up is like screenshots of modern day Earth. Japan, maybe Tokyo, I don't know, maybe New York or something like that. And there's this concept of humans, and humans, quote unquote, in this game are not the people that exist, the majority of persons in this world. No, humans are the most feared creatures possible. The commoners whisper about them.
Like these Hieronymus Bosch monstrosities.
Yes, the kings and lords promise that they're going to destroy the scourge of humans. So humans and fantasy and story seems to be referencing us. Mundane.
Our world is the fantasy all along.
Our world is their fantasy. So a lot of interesting twisting things. And yeah, a lot of freakish body horror in there. Anyways, I've contemporized there, but ultimately, in the end, it's a JRPG. There's a nameless protagonist. He's of one of the, what is there, 12 tribes or something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, the Elder.
He's one of the Elder, which I think he's the only Elder you see really around in most cases. And then there's these other tribes, which are like, I guess, castes of intelligent beings. And some have horns and some have long ears and some wear boxes on their heads and some flit around with wings.
You're talking cat some people.
Are angelic. Yeah, there's cat people. And there's a lot of known races of intelligent beings. Oh, there's dog people, of course. Some are treated well. And some are treated badly. And you are of very low status as the main character. And unlike the Persona games, the thing I thought was cool about this game is that you start with a mission. There's so many structural things that are similar to Persona games, but so many story things that are different. Where do you think we should start, since I'm just kind of jumping all over there with covering this? Like mechanics or... story or yeah, setting?
Yeah, you go into the story a bit, because as you said, this, I mean, Persona games always take a while to sort of roll out and reveal what they're really about, whereas this kind of throws you in with a clear mission from the get-go in terms of you basically trying to you're looking after the prince who has been sort of absconded and sort of at death's door, missing for years, but you secretly know where he is. You're trying to sort of
you're trying to return him to power.
Yeah, well,
to become the once and future king
and cure him, I guess is the thing. Yeah
So basically the prince is Sleeping Beauty,
right?
You and Secret Order are charged with sort of protecting them, and your mission as the protagonist is to bring like-minded people together to advance his return to power
with the power even of democracy. Though there's
yeah, which is interesting. A strange event occurs. The previous king is sort of taken out of the picture. And then this sort of, I don't know, godly presence who calls themselves the king shakes up the whole land by saying that we will have an open event to hear the voices of the people. Everyone will get they don't call it a vote, but it'll get their say. And they get to back a champion. And then basically anyone could be the next king. It's not limited to men. It's not limited to any one of those various tribes. It could be anyone. But there are some clear front runner characters. The characters essentially have power to begin with. And you are at the very opposite end of the scale. And the story is of your character's sort of rise to power, notoriety, by doing various deeds. And these sort of champions, these candidates, they ride these strange vehicles called, what are they called?
The runners?
Steam runners or something to that end. And some of them, most of them walk on land. They're big kind of like industrial devices, like ships.
Kind of like metal silk ships. Striders from Morrowind or something.
but they run on legs. So, and one of them, of the very powerful antagonists, flies in the air, so that one's very rare. So this game is very reminiscent of a lot of traditional European fantasy stories. It is also reminiscent a lot of the mechanisms of JRPGs, but it's kind of like in conversation with them and trying to reinterpret them. And that's what I really find exciting about this game. So you essentially, the structure of the game is that you will meet companions along the way. just like a lot of the other Atlas JRPGs. They will wield their power in turn-based combat. You will, every kind of segment of the game, of which I've played through three of them so far, three main areas, you have a goal. In the Persona games, it was to take down one of these dungeons, one of these palaces, I think they were called in Persona 5. But in this case, it's different every time. It's sort of like one leg of the challenge, of the campaign to win power. You're given a literal deadline. So at X date, we're going to have a presentation. You got to show us your achievement. You got to bring us the head of an evil beast or creature. Show us how important and powerful and
usually it means running some kind of dungeon. But the way you go about that is there's some different framings of how they approach each dungeon, at least. It's not the same. It's not like doing a heist in a formulaic way like Persona 5 was.
Yeah, Persona 5 I felt was like very, very restricted in that the dungeon of the, I guess, the chapter was all-consuming. And it was large. And you would visit it multiple times. It says, you made it through all these X levels out of 30, but you couldn't take another step further. You better go back and have some rest and maybe write your midterm exams in the meanwhile. Right? That was the structure of Persona, which maybe you're detecting from my tone of voice, but always rubbed me the wrong way. It was just like the pacing is just getting to an interesting point, and they send you back into this like relationship generating management game and time management game of Japanese high schoolers, which was always a little strange.
I always struggled with that in that you couldn't optimize everything. You had to very much pick and choose who you were going to be friends with, what stats you're going to level up, and you're always falling behind. But if you just followed what you were interested in, you'd probably finish the game with a fraction of what you could possibly do in that game. Whereas me, the completionist, wants to optimize all the social bonds, so then I end up following a guide, and then I end up just feeling unsatisfying as I go by the numbers. And so, yeah, I never finished Persona 5. I enjoyed Persona 4. I didn't finish 5. I like them, but I'm still trying to sort of reconcile my feelings on them, and as whether it's the game's fault or how I approach them, and sort of trying to break away from that sense of completionist.
I'm in a very similar boat to you. I enjoyed the heck out of Persona 4 Golden. I played it extensively on the PS Vita, and I beat it. But I got an unsatisfactory ending, and I feel like it was because I sort of followed my interests and I followed my initial inclinations, and I didn't follow a guide. And as a result, my storyline wasn't optimized. And that pissed me the heck off.
But here's the thing. Metaphor lets you do everything. You can quite easily complete all of the side quests, maximize all of the goals, and you're not going to be missing out on everything. But in the same sense, it also feels like I'm sort of going through the motions. Like I'm on where I'm currently at. I've got 15 days to complete this goal. Well, within 5 days, I've done the side quests that I can. So I've got 10 days left to fill in. Okay, I guess I'll just run through all of the relationships I can level up. Okay, I've done those. I've still got 5 days. I guess I'm going to level up my wisdom. I don't know. What is there to do now?
Yeah, you're right. There is that sort of overall structure is like you have about a month, best manage your time really well. So you really only have to worry about advancing the primary goal about, I don't know, maybe like 5 days before the deadline, if that. But you have to tackle these other side challenges. So there's these bounties, I guess, that you can track. Those are pretty common. And then there's literal side missions that townsfolk will send you on, or even your companions. You can have companion quests, which will open up new stories. I think for the most part, the bounties are pretty meaty. They're the sort of like proper, like full-size encounters. The companion missions almost reach that level. There's, you know, custom dialogue. You get to reveal new aspects of characters. And then the side missions for random townsperson B don't really matter at all. What I really liked about this game is that there are a lot of characters. There's a large cast of characters. The main party members are all quite charming and distinct. And because they are adults, for the most part, with, you know, careers, relationships of their own, passions and drives of their own, they're a lot more interesting and less insipid and less of just like these pastiches of manga tropes.
You can explore a lot more sort of wider, like, variety of arcs and sort of drives in these characters, right?
Yeah, because they're adults and because of all those reasons I mentioned, they're a lot more interesting in their own right. And you want to develop relationships with them of your own accord rather than just feeling obligated to doing it. But unlike Persona games in the past, I felt like motivated to build relationships with a lot of the side characters also. Some of the secondary characters you meet along the way, like, I don't know, the guard from this second town. He was, you know, a charming fellow, kind of becomes your sort of ally along the way. Various other side characters, this vendor of magical items from the early main town, or the child of a ally who sort of falls under your sort of, not supervision, just sort of like care in various ways, sort of like an adopted child. Very charming that way too. So I felt a lot of them I was drawn to of my own accord, and I wanted to spend time with them, not just because I saw a little yellow exclamation point flag on the map, but because, oh, I want to, I feel like I should give them attention. So I felt motivated to pursue those side quests.
I do find it very strange, these little weird little pop quizzes you get every time you're talking to these characters, though. Like, it presents you the illusion of a choice of how you're going to interact with them. Are you going to be supportive, or are you going to, like, tell them off? Usually it's like three different flavors of being supportive, and you've got to choose which is the correct one, because you'll get some bonus points if you do that. But it feels very arbitrary. It's like, why give you, either make it a more interesting choice, or just don't bother at all.
Yeah, I think the stories themselves are interesting, but you're right. The responses you give are not very impactful for the most part. I think it just depends on whether you get 2 points, 3 points, or 4 points.
Yeah, yeah.
Based on the replies that you make. So yeah, I'll give you that there. They're not too intriguing, but a lot more interesting story-wise than Persona by far. I really couldn't give a damn about a lot of those side characters from Persona 5 or even Persona 3 Reload, which I played recently. Just a little bit underbaked, a lot of those
characters. I do find some of the characters a little too earnest in Metaphor, I will say. Like, it's missing a little bit of the wackiness that you'd get in those sort of more contemporary settings.
You don't think Metaphor is wacky?
It can be sometimes. I guess mostly in Heisenberg's weird eating obsession, but...
Hulkenberg and Heisme, you're thinking of. Yes. Those are two different characters. But yeah, Hulkenberg is hilarious. Heisme too. I really like the character designs. Like, they're just so... They're obviously European-inspired, except for Heisme. He's sort of Japanese-inspired. But some of these creatures are designed in really sort of like exaggerated ways. Like, the elves are like even more sort of angular.
Very pointy.
With their ears, like just pointing out like 2 feet out from either side. Way more than, you know, the trad fantasy that you see from sort of Lord of the Rings and Dungeons and Dragons earlier editions. The variations between the... sort of Yujif characters, the bat-like characters like Heisme, and then the cutesy Yujif that you see in town.
Because you see quite a bit of variety within each race. It's not each race isn't monolithic itself.
Yeah, and that part I really appreciated, because it helped develop this idea that you're living in a real world.
Mm.
Even though not a lot of the balance of things or the structure of things felt really realistic, it just felt like fleshed out, sort of like, you know, the world of Oz, you know, like all of these things are strange, but there's like a sort of internal logic to them in how they interconnect that I really enjoyed.
It does fall into some of the traps of sort of fantasy racism, I find. Like, it does at least try to explore some of the more systematic sort of causes and background to this, like the interpersonal relationships between all the races. It does fall into like, well, we can solve this by just being really nice and friendly and earnest, and they'll vote for that, right? And it's a little too earnest in how it approaches what the solution to that might be, I think.
I like the bits most in the story where you have to encounter and interact with the other candidates of the sort of election, if you want to call it that, because each of them has a sort of pitch, right? You know, like sometimes you have to literally pitch your cause. They have party platforms. They have promises that they're going to give. Like one of them is like, let's make everything a party. Let's free drinks. Bar on every corner, everything's going to be a blast. And another one is all about beauty. Those who are the most beautiful should wield the most power, or those who are the eldest should be respected, and those of the youngest should labor to benefit them, or something like that. And one of them is just this like scrappy dog-like character who you meet, or is it a cat-like? It's hard to say. But she's sort of like a frenemy, right?
Mm.
And so you meet them.
Katarina, I think?
She has pink hair. Yeah, Katarina. That's her name. You meet her multiple times along the way, and she's kind of like stubborn, right? Obviously, like she's not going to win. But she believes in herself and just kind of butts her head against the challenges of the world. And you can't help but wanting to support her. And you just meet these characters once over and over again.
Hey, she calls out for bringing back guillotines. My vote's for Katarina.
Yeah, Katarina's awesome, actually. I would get a tattoo of her, or like a patch of her on a leather jacket or something. She's super cool. But you encounter these characters again and again, and you're like, yeah, am I pursuing the right angle? Because essentially you're a restorationist, right?
Yes, yeah, it's a big like democracy battle, for lack of a better term,
right?
But you're basically just representing the prince to restore him, so it's very strange.
You're a monarchist.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
So you're trying to win this democratic debate to restore this this monarchist, which I personally think is
there's going to be a twist, obviously. BS. I have not.
Yeah, but I don't know. It just seems ironic, and I don't know. I think a lot of Japanese studios, especially, are just pro monarchists, right? Mm. Because like that's their tradition. Like Canada, in a lot of ways, they're constitutional monarchies, and a lot of those then believe, oh well, the monarch has the best intentions for me. There can be great, good kings and queens. I believe there ain't no good kings and queens anytime,
anywhere. Yeah, the way they frame this sort of democratic battle is very strange. Because then the church sort of co-opts it into this tournament that has nothing to do with the actual sort of power that's overseeing this battle, but like everyone just follows along with the structure of this tournament for no particular reason.
Right, but this game is interesting in that, kind of like, I don't know, 1960s Star Trek is sort of coloring everything as a metaphor. You know, they're calling into question a lot of modern day beliefs, a lot of modern day political and religious beliefs, and in this sort of fantasy RPG space. And it's not exactly the most cutting commentary, but it at least they are tackling it in a way that not a lot of
deeper than most games do.
Right.
of this sort of scope. Yeah.
Yeah, not exactly super well balanced, but they're still asking the questions. They're still going there. And for that, I appreciate it. If more games did more like commentary like this, perhaps in even more cutting way and in a more educated way, it would be very intriguing. So I like that this game touches upon those areas.
I will say final nitpick, though. There's one character, not the name names, there's one character who has murdered a bunch of children, and because she feels sad about it, the characters all forgive her. It's like, you do not have to give it to the child murderer.
Right, like, yeah, she sort of redeems herself, quote-unquote.
Yeah, this falls a little too much into the earnestness, sensitive, feel-good vibes of how you can solve the world.
Yeah. So this, I would say, we're trying to wrap it up at this point now. I've played about 33, 34 hours of this.
About the same.
I haven't finished it. I'm just in the kind of third largest area. It sounds like you and I are in similar spaces. And this game, I said it's a streamlining, sort of extension of Persona. It doesn't streamline everything away. It does some really smart things, which I really appreciate. Like, you can skip random combat. Or you can skip combat encounters for enemies that are weaker than yours. So most battles in Persona 5 say you would run into the character under the screen. You could whack them first and get an advantage. You can also do that here. Or they can whack you first and they get an advantage, which also happens here. But if you encounter a monster that you're over-leveled for, you can just whack them and they're gone. You just whack them with a sword from the over map and they're gone. You don't have to enter an encounter. You still get XP. Just streamlines that whole thing. And you only have to go into combat encounters for encounters that matter, essentially.
And I do like, as I mentioned in a recent episode, I do really like how you mix and match those classes in battle.
Yes.
Every character can be any class, basically. You're not like locked to specific elements like you were in Persona.
Yeah, I think this sort of method of leveling up your character is one of the most exciting that I've played in a long time.
So there's so much customization there.
Right, like you said, in Persona 5, a side character was locked to this persona. They could only play that. The advantage of the primary character is that they could load up multiple personas. They're sort of like the chosen one, the only one who can do that. But in this game, you can load up for each of your characters any one quote-unquote persona at a time. And they can, depending on how leveled they are, they can inherit abilities from other personas, quote-unquote, that you have used in the past. And there's a wide-ranging array of character classes that those personas can take. I think you start off with something like 8 or 10, and then as you build relationships with people around you, it unlocks even kind of extensions, like subclasses. I think you start with the healer, for instance, and you can unlock the cleric.
You've got to level up, max out the healer first before you can like sort of advance to the sort of master class beyond that.
Right.
So yeah, it's quite a lot of layers to that system, and like getting the most out of it. You can mix and match like skills between some classes by using the magla points.
Yep, and you can buy these pieces of equipment called igniters, which will give you access to like one elemental spell, which is really quite valuable when you have talked to the informant. He lets you know that monsters in this dungeon are strong, are impervious to fire, but weak to ice.
Well, these monsters really hate healers. Don't bring a healer. Like, yeah, every dungeon tends to have these weird quirks that forces you to experiment and sort of try some new combinations there.
Yeah, so that part I really appreciate. And I just think the missions are taken on in a streamlined way, but there is a lot of missable content. So if you're not keeping your eyes open, if you're not checking everywhere, you will miss a lot of things too. So I'm just going to do one small last tangent. Is I saw on social media somewhere, someone was saying on Blue Sky that JRPGs are sort of such a established genre that it seems as though all JRPGs are trying to strip away what makes them a JRPG and that other games are taking on sort of like the trope structure of JRPGs. And to some degree, that's true, but I do appreciate the streamlining. I think this is a strong example. Sort of what Dragon Quest III HD Remake we talked about the other day streamlines a lot of nice things as well. This is a great balance, and I think it's pointing towards interesting things that they can do with the genre while stripping away the things that are sort of just had their day.
I am really enjoying so many of the quality of life features here, but I am surprised to find myself missing some of the friction from Persona, like in being forced to make a decision and like choosing between which character do I want to spend time with, where do I want to go in this world, and trying to sort of, it forces you to engage in that world a little more, engage in the characters, and force you to sort of make a decision in what you want to do rather than just going through the motion of doing everything. But that's me as a completionist, and I'm trying to fight that in myself to some extent. So yeah, I'm not sure how much of that is the game and how much of that is how I approach it. So
you're a completionist and you're asking for more missable content. Is that?
Well, I'm trying. That's me trying to better myself and not be such a completionist. Yeah, and I think I'm retroactively appreciating how Persona did some of those things. But there's lots to love here too.
yeah. And I've harped on Persona a lot. Persona is still great. Obviously, they're sort of at the zenith of a lot of style and creativity in JRPG space. They have been for so long. that I will still obviously play the next Persona game, but this sort of has been a refreshing change of pace, sort of like a second tier, just like Bethesda Game Studios has Elder Scrolls and Fallout. Well, now Atlas can have Persona and Metaphor and whatever next game they come out with.
Applying that formula of the having the structure, the calendar structure and all the relationships, but applying that to a completely different format and setting is really engaging. I recently mentioned, what was the game? Dungeons of Hinterberg. Did that, a little bit of that too, in like a resort town setting and fighting through dungeons. So that was another cool take on that. But yeah, it's a lot more to sort of mine in that structure.
Yeah, for sure. I think, I'm not done with JRPGs yet. I think there are still promising things for the future. But I've talked at length about Metaphor, so I'm happy to leave it there.
Okay. Why don't we wrap that up?
All right. And quick dessert?
Yeah. Well, I've avoided talking about more manga and anime for a few episodes now, but I'm going back to that well. That I've been returning to an old favorite for years. I'd only ever seen one anime, and it was a bit of a deep cut. That I've returned to quite recently, and that is Nichiju, My Ordinary Life. So the original manga was by Kaichi Arawi, I think is how you pronounce that name. And the anime was by Kyoto Animation. So this is the animation was is over 15 years old now, I think. It's been out for quite some time. Very interesting sort of structure. It doesn't really have any story or plot. Each episode is just like little slice of life skits in this town. You have central characters, like this is a big ensemble group of characters, and each skit is just like them going to school or going to the shops and these weird little skits. Mostly this like sort of absurdist humor. What really plays with in a fun way is this sort of the catastrophization that students, like every little thing, like, oh, I accidentally gave my sketch of my crush to my friend and this other person's going to see it. It's the end of the world. Like literally a bomb goes off as if their world has blown up, or like there's this 5-minute cutscene of them trying to chase down their notebook. And there's really excellent action comedy, like just the way it sort of paced the action, really, really hard cuts for emphasis. It's just incredible animation for such a small scope in story. Has some incredible animation to some amazing effects and just cute characters. And I love it. I've been reading the manga again as well. But partly the reason I'm revisiting this is that they just announced that author's follow-up manga, City, is now also being made into an anime by the same studio, coming out in a couple of months. So City, the animation, I think it's called, coming out soon. Very similar style in terms of it being slice of life characters, more adult characters rather than a school setting. And the art style in the series, at least, is much more vibrant and colorful. It looks a little bit like Scott Pilgrim. Similar animation style, but the character design, the much stronger, sharper color palette there. So interesting to see how that changes things up.
Yeah, I have read a couple of chapters of City. I just started recently. I think I found it on the K manga app, which K is for Kodansha, which is a big publisher of manga in Japan, and here in North America as well. So this is their North American app, which has started releasing a bunch of stuff. Like I think you mentioned, what was it, Shangri-La Frontier the other day.
Yes,
that's on K-Manga as well. So I don't know a lot about City, but I do like slice of life a bit. I'm a little annoyed by slice of life sometimes, because literally I'm just like, come on, something happen, please, something, some plot, please happen. But I do like gags. I'm starting to slightly get into gag manga, which was never really something I did before. Also, a bit lacking on plot. But one of them I enjoyed recently is called... actually, it's the show. It was on Netflix anime. It's called Psyche K. So the character's last name is Psyche. And he's a sort of One Punch Man style superhuman. So he has telepathy, he can teleport, he has super strength, he has time manipulation effects, but he just hates all of his powers because it just annoys him to no end hearing everyone's thoughts and being asked to fix everything for his lazy dad or things like that. So it's a bit of a gag about all these wacky characters in his life and all these absurd situations that he runs into. So that show is well worth a watch on Netflix, and I believe that's from manga as well. Might try and hunt out the manga that it originated from, because I just want to see more antics of that cast of characters.
Humor can be tough in manga, especially just in the, especially, I mean, as from a Western audience, so much of it is based on cultural touchstones I don't have. Like in Nichijou especially, yeah. It's very much, it's all about, there's a lot of jokes about the high school club and how those are organized, which I have no experience in. I think in the anime has a little more focus on the action and the pacing and can control that more, even if the jokes don't entirely land. So the manga takes a little more work, I think, to appreciate.
Yeah, there's, I think, stories like Psyche K and another one, which is like, what is it? Komi Can't Communicate, which is another anime based on a manga that is set in high school. But just like the characters, all the characters that you run into are just like over the top tropes. And because they take those tropes to such an extreme, you just can't help but laugh at them because it's such absurdist humor.
Yes,
right?
Yeah.
So that I absolutely enjoy. All right, I'm going to briefly talk about the media that I have been watching. So I'm not talking about a movie or an anime this time. I'm talking about a Western digital animation. This one is a show, a very short series called The Amazing Digital Circus. It's on Netflix. As far as I know, that's where it originated. I think it only has like something like 4 episodes or something like that. But the cover art seemed interesting to me. It was just sort of on my backlog for a while. And then I was watching some Japan videos trying to plan for my trip. And I saw that they had an anime cafe style pop-up the show, which is ostensibly a Western show. It has nothing to do with Japan as far as I'm aware. So this show, have you watched Amazing Digital Circus?
No, I watched the trailer before recording tonight. That's all I've known.
Okay, yeah. I've only watched 1 episode of it, by the way, so I'm just going to really give my impressions. But this show is really inventive in a lot of ways. It has this distinctive 90s aesthetic to it. Like, it literally starts with this pixelated intro to make it look like a old show. Like, it's like a show like 90s, that existed.
90s VR cyberpunk sort of aesthetic, like reboots, yeah, I guess.
Like reboot, like Beast really Wars. low res, low poly, low texture 3D animation, 3D CG animation. And in this case, it's supposed to look like that, obviously, and it's also supposed to be a little bit off-putting, kind of like watching Toy Story 1 is a little bit off-putting, right? Those characters don't look right. And in this case, a lot of the characters don't look right. But it's set in this fantasy world, and the main character is this sort of Harlequin female clown sort of character. And she doesn't know why she's there. She doesn't remember her life. And she's encountering all these wacky cast of characters. They're all these sort of tropes. But they're all a little bit disturbing and disturbed at the same time. And this show, I think it was like PG-13 or something like that. I watched it with my 13-year-old and my 10-year-old. And while we were watching it, I felt like I don't think this is right. I don't think this is right for my youngest. But my 13-year-old loved it because it is just that level of humor of like kind of slightly disconcerting, upsetting humor was, I guess, just right for their taste right now. This show reminds me of, you watched Star Trek The Next Generation, right?
Half of it.
Yeah. So you might not have reached this episode yet. There is an episode where of TNG where Worf's son Alexander, who you may have encountered, is befriended by Lwaxana Troi. Basically, they become friends, and Alexander's having a hard time listening to rules. And Lwaxana Troi is like, "Rules, schmools, live it up," or whatever. And basically, like he cheers her up. She is sad, but she teaches him life lessons. It's a whole heartwarming story. But Lwaxana Troi takes Alexander to this strange, bizarro fantasy world on the holodeck, which is full of of really rudimentary early CG animation because it's the 1990s or the late 80s. And I was just instantly taken back to there about how disturbing a digital clown can be. And both of these shows are equally replete.
I'm having some flashbacks to that 3D episode clowns. Of The Simpsons. I think it was like a Treehouse of Horror where it's like 3D Simpsons. Yeah.
3D Homer, right? They visit the third dimension.
Bouncing geometric shapes and things. And yeah, very, very abstract and weird. Yeah.
Yeah. Seeing a third dimension of Homer and Bart is the most disturbing thing of any of those episodes, let me tell you. But this show is really interesting. The plot is not really that overwhelming.
Mm.
And it goes to, you know, it wraps it up, at least in the first episode, in a tight way. But the thing that's impressive about the show is the tone. It just has this such a sense of dread to it. You feel lack of control, just like that primary character. You feel like you're sort of being gaslit while you're watching this. It's like, what are the rules of the universe that I've entered? And there's like slight degrees of like body horror, like the characters like lose limbs and they lose control of their bodies and they can become paralyzed and vulnerable. So that's why I would say probably not suitable for younger kids, but probably older kids and teens would really get a hoot out of it. And for adults, if you like kind of horrific sort of dreadful atmosphere, you will like it this too.
The aesthetics do look like a lot. I was very overstimulated watching that trailer. It kind of feels like sort of Hot Topic goth vibes, a little bit of Nightmare Before Christmas and like Adventure Time sort of thrown in there. Just the sort of wackiness, things that are so random and weird that I don't entirely jive with. But if the writing and jokes are solid, maybe I'll check it out. But yeah, it's a lot.
I think, I mean, maybe the trailer you saw is probably extra intense, but this show, at very least, it has wacky things, but it centers the story pretty tightly on the main character's sort of personal motivations. Like, why am I in the situation that I'm in? I need to get a little more control of this universe. I need to know what's going on. I need to be able to decipher these problems for myself.
It was like some sort of existential Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead sort of surrealism play.
Yeah, they're absolutely surreal. And there's this mysterious exit door that the main character is trying to find. So there's like a promise of more layers, which I'm enticed.
Okay, and only four episodes. Keep watching. Never know.
Yeah, that's right. So there's an interesting show. You should go check it out. That's another amazing, the amazing Digital Circus on Netflix.
Excellent.
All right. So that's been another episode of the Omnis Gamers Club podcast with our new format well in swing. Like we told you before, we'll try and set up something for the 100th episode next time. Who knows what it'll look like. Maybe we'll have another guest join us. All right. Shall we give people the outro then?
Yeah, well, if you have any thoughts or feelings on today's games or animation or any suggestions you'd like us to check out, you can contact us at omnigamersclub@gmail.com or at our website, omnigamers.club. And you can also find us on Blue Sky at omnigamersclub or myself at Board Game Feast.
Yep, and I'm Omnigamer Mark at Blue Sky as well. You can catch us on YouTube where we post these videos whenever they come out for each episode that comes out. Or if you caught us there already, you can get us in audio form at the podcatcher of your choosing. We'd love to see comments, positive ratings. We'll do our best to catch them. We might miss, you'd be a few days late, but we'll do our very best to get back to you when you reach out to us on those platforms.
Yeah, if you want to leave us a little review for our 100th episode, that would be a lovely gift.
Love to hear it. Give us some recommendations for games to cover in the near future.
Yeah, that's it. It's new format. Let's just try new things. So throw us some suggestions.
Absolutely. We can always fit another game in or two. Okay, Daniel. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Till episode 100.
Have a balanced diet of games. That's the catchphrase, right? Sorry, I blanked there.
It's something we do.
Yeah.
Thanks all.
Thank you. Bye.